Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next guest is Jason Ware. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Albion Financial Group, a company that I also work for. And Jason, we had you as a guest in late February, February 24th. And when we talked at that time, the nation was hopeful that we might be spared from a widespread outbreak of coronavirus. Sadly, that did not turn out to be the case. Our world is very different now than it was when we talked to you in late February. As everybody, all listeners know, Park City and the rest of the nation experienced a dramatic economic shutdown. And in that short 10 weeks, 12 weeks since we spoke to you last, now we have tens of millions of additional Americans unemployed that had jobs when we spoke last. And so, Jason, first off, welcome to Mountain Money. We appreciate you being on the show. And we want to start off with, you know, what does all this mean? What does it mean for the economy? What does it mean for the markets?
Hello, good morning, Doug and Allison, and thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure, and that's a great question, Doug, and it's really central to the economic trajectory over both the short and medium term. I mean, as you noted, in the past several weeks, we've seen, unfortunately, millions of Americans lose their jobs given the shutdown, given the forced lockdowns that the economy has been subject to and the reduced economic activity that's resulted from that. And the reality is that There's two sides of this coin, and one of them is fairly optimistic, and the other one is less so. Let's start with the bad news. The bad news is that having 36 to 37 million people suddenly unemployed is absolutely going to make a large dent in aggregate demand, and that fall off in aggregate demand trickles through the real economy through lower sales at businesses, lower profits at businesses, further layoffs, and that you have this negative spiral in the economy that is difficult to get out of without either A, the economy getting back on track, or B, massive policy support from Congress. And the good news is we're seeing that from Congress, and we're likely to get more stimulus and more support as time goes on. The other side of that is a little bit more optimistic. And what we're seeing in some of the anecdotal data so far is that a number of the people that have lost their jobs as a result of this pandemic are fairly confident that on the other side of this, in short order, they will be able to come back to a job that is waiting for them. So if these job losses are temporary and it allows us to get back on track at a fairly accelerated rate on the other side of this, maybe that's in 3 months, maybe it's in 6 months. But if the idea that these businesses are still around and they still have jobs to come back to, That paints a more rosy picture that maybe in a few months' time, if we can manage the virus and if we can get therapeutics and a vaccine here in the next 12 months, that the economy can recover in a healthy enough way that is beneficial to society.
Jason, as you mentioned, there are approximately 37 million people now unemployed, and the hope is that jobs are waiting for them, but are there specific industries or is there a general industry in which those that are unemployed were working in?
As far as the job losses, we've certainly seen a concentration of job losses in those businesses that require in-person activity, those businesses that are most impacted by us moving to mass social distancing. So obviously restaurants and leisure and travel, you know, airlines, hotels, a lot of retail have seen a big fall off in economic activity, a big fall off in folks coming to their establishments. And of course, that makes sense. Most people are not comfortable doing those types of activities right now. And B, we've obviously had, again, as I mentioned, a forced lockdown. About a third of the economy has been literally taken offline since this pandemic began, because of the mass self-isolation that we've all been practicing for the past several weeks. So yes, there has been certainly an area of acute focus with regards to the job losses. And on the other side of this, if we do get a vaccine where people feel comfortable coming back out into the economy and behaving in a fairly normal way as they did prior to the virus, then I think the good news is there's going to be a resurgence of demand there, and therefore we should see some of those jobs return. I think it's worth noting that as we go through the unemployment report, as we go through the jobless claims reports, I mean, these are real people. You know, as an economist, it's we have to look at this with an objective eye. But the reality is that each one of these individuals have lost jobs. You know, it's heartbreaking, and our heart goes out to them. But looking at it as an economist and looking at the types of jobs that are being lost, I think the good news, if you can even say there is any good news in this, is that so far those temporary job losses have centered on lower income type positions. And while that's difficult for those individuals, as we look at it at the macro level, that means that the income, the total income in the economy, hasn't fallen as much as it would have had some of these jobs come from other sectors and other fields. And that paradoxically is actually less damaging to the overall economy. So I think that's, if there's any silver lining in this, it's that maybe the economic pain from 36 million jobs, which is a lot of jobs, that is a huge number of jobs, something we haven't seen in 80 years. But given the median income of the job loss, it hasn't been quite as hasn't had quite the negative impact on the economy as one might expect.
Yeah, and we share your empathy for that. While those might be lower paying jobs, they're critical to the people that are trying to make rent payments and put food on the table for their family. And Jason, as you know, we've got a large service community here in Park City, so the audience here is a large part of the audience is living that pain right now. And their question is, you know, how soon are we going to get back to normal? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, and it's the question, as you noted, you know, everyone is really thinking about. And I think, you know, the path forward is going to be a function of science, and that's a little bit different than past recessions. In fact, it's very different than past recessions where, you know, often is the case we have a contraction in the economy that's based on traditional business cycle factors, whether it's, you know, over borrowing or overconfidence or overspending. We have the Fed that will over tighten and cool the economy, and sometimes that can send us into a quote unquote garden variety recession. But this time around, the economy was shut down by a virus, and it will likely only reopen on the other side of this, you know, as dictated by the virus. And whether that's because it slows down and we manage it in a way that allows us to reemerge from our homes and get out and behave in a way that looks something similar to what we were doing 6 months ago, or whether that's a therapeutic from a biotech company that really brings down the mortality rate or shortens the disease of COVID-19 in a way that people feel more comfortable getting outside. Or really, I think the big event everyone's waiting for that's going to be the game changer in how society, the relationship we have with the virus and the economic activity that we're doing, is going to be a vaccine. And the good news there is that we're seeing a lot of really exciting data, and the path forward on getting to a vaccine has been nothing short of remarkable. I mean, typically this is a multi-year workout period where we go from recognizing the virus to creating a vaccine for it. But this time around, inside of 9 months, really less than that, more like 6 months, we've been able to identify the genome of this virus, and there are several companies and several governments that are working nonstop on this. The scientific community is going full bore trying to create a vaccine, and we're seeing some really optimistic data from companies like Moderna and Pfizer and AstraZeneca in partnership with Oxford University over in the United Kingdom. So I think ultimately it's going to be a vaccine that probably gets us back to normal, and that's probably still a ways off. But I'm encouraged by what we're seeing along that route.
So Doug and I mentioned last week on the show, you know, back to normal and what does normal mean after all of this? And of course, with a vaccine, I think we get back to our normal habits of giving people hugs, hello, and sitting next to each other in an airplane. But can you give us just a little insight as far as airlines and what that industry is looking like through this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And what's interesting is that, you know, as you sketched out, I think a vaccine allows us to go back to a very similar semblance of normal prior to the coronavirus. And I think it's going to be slow. It's not going to be a light switch that we flip back on. I think travel, even with a vaccine, you know, memories fade, but it takes some time. So there's probably going to be a slow recovery in the airline industry. But I think over the long term, we get there. I think, you know, Over time, we will adjust back to what we're used to. And in particular, if we have a vaccine and we all feel confident in that vaccine and it's proven to have high efficacy, then I think we'll get there. But what's interesting about the airline industry is they're not just facing the virus anymore. They're facing the change in habits, both at the consumer level and more importantly, at the enterprise or the company level, that is going to act as a headwind to part of their business that maybe is a bit unexpected. And what I mean by that is, a big chunk of airline profitability is business travel. And one of the things we've learned in shutting ourselves in and working from home and being quarantined is that maybe we don't need to travel to every meeting that we used to. Maybe we don't need to go to that conference because it now streams digitally over Zoom. Maybe we don't need to have those quarterly gatherings with our clients or with folks that we do business with, our vendors. That can all be done in a way over teleconference that wasn't really embraced before this. So I think if business travel slows or doesn't return to old levels in a way that the airline needs it to, that might be an incremental headwind that is not because of the virus, because again, a vaccine obviously would help assuage those fears, but it's a change in behavior that resulted from the self-quarantining that doesn't bode well for that part of the airline's business. So that's kind of an interesting way to think about, maybe two steps forward and one step back for the airlines over the long term.
Yeah, and speaking two steps forward, two steps back, another idiom we use is two sides of the coin. And this week we saw two sides of a coin of a very important person in our country right now, the Fed Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell. He had a national interview that he did on a widely viewed TV show, 60 Minutes. He was also in front of the Senate giving his thoughts on the potential impact and what we need to do going forward. And there were very different testimonies. He had a very hopeful tone in the 60 Minutes interview, and he had a very cautionary tone in front of the Senate. Tell us about that and what your takeaway is from both of those viewpoints.
Sure. So his interview with 60 Minutes on Sunday, he's speaking to a very different audience than his testimony in front of the Senate a couple of days ago. And that audience is, the public. It's America at large. And I think Jerome Powell's message there is we're here to offer all the support that the Federal Reserve can possibly offer to financial markets and the economy. And that message is don't panic. It's we will get through this. We'll have to work with each other. We'll have to, we're going to have patience, but we will get through this. And I think it certainly behooves not only the Federal Reserve, but the economy at large for the average American to not panic, for the average American to continue to the extent that they can, continue with some semblance of a quarantine style approach to the economy where they're still spending, whether that's spending on Amazon or whether that's, still doing takeout and curbside service at your local restaurant, or whether that's, still having some level of activity that keeps the economy going and doesn't shut us all in a way that really makes a bad situation worse. So I think his message on 60 Minutes is one of optimism, and it's properly placed. Meanwhile, a few days later, he's talking to Congress, and I think his tone there was definitely more cautious, and it was more concerned about what this virus might do to the economy still over the next 6 to 12 months until we get to a vaccine, and the support that the fiscal side of the ledger, that is congressional spending, can provide to the economy in bridging the chasm between here and then. So his message to Congress was a little bit more downbeat because he would like them to do more. And of course, Jerome Powell has been, I would argue, a very competent Fed chief. And I think he understands that he wants to stay in his lane. It's not his job to go to Congress and say explicitly, you need to spend more and here's how you need to do it. He wants to be respectful of that body. But he also is in charge of helping see the economy through tough times as a Fed chair. That's absolutely part of his purview. And they're doing everything they can with trillions of dollars to try to smooth the financial markets as the economy works through this. And that investment in America that investment in the financial markets that the Federal Reserve is attempting to do will all be for naught if Congress doesn't do their job, or it certainly won't have near the impact that it would if Congress doesn't do their job. So, you know, the Congress has already spent $3 trillion. That's a large amount. That's about 15% of GDP. It's the largest mobilization of federal spending that we've seen since World War II, and we celebrate that, and I think most of the American public celebrates that. We go back to what we were talking about earlier, Doug, with some of these jobs, lower wage jobs that have been lost, the fact that they've provided unemployment insurance in a larger amount of unemployment insurance has been excellent, and that's important, and we need to continue to see that. And I think that's what Jerome Powell's message was to Congress is, you know, don't let up now. We still need you to get through this. We're not the worst, maybe behind us in some ways, but now is not the time to get complacent. And I think that probably underlies the difference between the two messages.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Jason, you and I have talked about this several times. Your views on this, I think, are really important. It's, you know, this is a scary time to be in the market. But yet the fundamentals of investing in solid companies are what help people weather the storm. Talk to us about your views or share your advice for our audience, folks that, you know, might be very nervous that the market's going to take another dip, and what should they do? Should they try to time the market and get out before the next correction? Should they stay the course? What's your advice?
So I like to say that time is your friend and impulse is your enemy, and it's really easy to succumb to our impulses in volatile market environments when we're seeing the stock market, you know, falling day after day, and fortunately we haven't seen that over the past few weeks. The market has rebounded considerably off of those lows in late March, but you know, certainly we're still in an environment where you know, people are nervous and people are scared. And understandably so. I mean, fear level is really high. We're facing something that we haven't faced before. We have, you know, people are nervous about their savings, they're nervous about their jobs, and they're nervous about their health. So that those three areas of fear have really impacted us in a way that's unusual. So I think it makes it even more important in this environment to take a step back where you can, to get away from some of the, you know, incoming information from not only your portfolio, but from the news sources that really can, you know, ignite that fear within us. So it's important to know what you own. It's important, you know, from the perspective of looking at your portfolio to have good companies that you're confident, you know, not only in 6 months will this company be fine, but really as I look down the road, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, I have a high degree of confidence that this business is going to be stronger than that it is today. And I think that really optimizes the portfolio for behavior when you understand what you own, when you recognize that this isn't just a piece of paper, this isn't just a stock that has an associated price with it at any given second while the market's open, and that could go up or down. And I really don't know why it goes up and down. It feels so random that it makes me nervous. When you strip away that surface level view of what a stock is, and you understand that really what that means is you're a part owner in that business, I think it allows you a level of clarity to not care so much about what the stock market's doing to that company today or next week or next month. But, you know, for example, with, you know, Costco, you know, is Costco going to be a business I want to own in 2021, in 2025, in 2030. As I'm looking down the road, not only through this pandemic, but on the other side of that, is that a business that to me suggests that there's going to be laudable returns on capital, a company that has a wide economic moat, that has strong balance sheet, that has a strong free cash flow profile, and that's something that I want to own as an investor, not so much a speculator on a stock price, which we just have no edge in and nobody can do well. So I think it's really important to understand for your listeners that when you own stocks, you own a portion of corporate America. It's not some piece of paper that just has, you know, a stock price that can go up or down. It really is an investment in a real tangible business. And I think when you understand that and when you overweight that perspective, it helps you get through challenging times like this.
Jason, I think the way that you just described how you own a stock, and that's like owning a portion of a corporation or a business, my background is more in local economies. And so when I look at the market and I look at the NASDAQ being, you know, 5% off its all-time high. But then I look at our local economy, which we're fearful about. Can you describe them? Because they seem almost opposite as far as their outlooks go right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good question. And taking the NASDAQ, for example, that is going to be that's an index that is really heavy in technology. It's heavy in biotechnology. And those are two areas that are really working in this economy, right? I mean, so when we think about work from home, what does that mean? That means more cloud usage. It means more internet usage. It means spending more time on your devices. It means more social media. It means more e-commerce. And the NASDAQ reflects those kind of companies. It means more cybersecurity because we're all logging in remotely or exchanging files in a way that and at a level that maybe we weren't doing a few months ago. So these trends that were already in place at these technology companies, and they were strong secular growth trends even before this pandemic began. There were multi-year business growth that these industries were seeing have only gotten stronger through this pandemic. So I think that's in part why the NASDAQ is doing well. Meanwhile, biotechnology, which is also a significant portion of the NASDAQ, these are companies where the therapies are going to come from. These are companies where the vaccines are going to come from. These are companies that are providing testing. These are companies that are providing the resource capacity to the healthcare system. And of course, that's been critical in this environment. So I think that's part of the reason why the NASDAQ as a slice of the market has performed quite well relative to some of the economic data that we're seeing, which has been terrible. I think looking at it a little bit more broadly at the S&P 500 level, you know, stocks are still off of their highs back on the 19th of February. But to your point, you know, the S&P is only down 13% off of its record high. Meanwhile, we have a lot of economic damage under the surface. And why is that? It's a great question. And I think even when you broaden out a little bit further and look beyond just the largest cap companies in the world incorporated in the S&P 500 and look at small caps, look at mid caps, look at some value sent portions of the market, we're seeing stocks still down 20-25% off of their highs. So, you know, to look at just one index and say, well, that's, you know, near all-time highs and the economy's not doing well, how do we square that? I think it requires a richer analysis. It requires peeling away some of those layers and trying to understand, well, what part of the stock market am I looking at, and how is that related to the economic environment we're in? And I think, you know, when you look at small cap companies, these are companies that are struggling more than some of these large cap technology and biotech companies. And I think that's the way that I would think about trying to understand what seems like a pretty stark divergence there.
Yeah, stark divergence is the right phrase. And it's, you know, I've been doing this a long time. You've been doing this a long time. Oftentimes, you do see those divergences. For instance, in the financial crisis, the market just really skyrocketed off of the bottom, really before we started to see the green shoots of that recovery. So hopefully the market is correct. Hopefully in 6 months from now, we're in a much more hopeful place and things are quite a bit stronger. On the note of optimism, Jason, probably our last question for today, you put together a report for our team internally of some good news that's out there. It's a daily recap. As you look at your good news report, what are two or three of the things that make you the most hopeful at this point?
Yeah, so I think first and foremost is the fact that we have flattened the curve. I mean, you'll recall that a couple of months ago, we were just becoming cognizant of what that even meant as a society. You know, social distancing was a new phrase. And I mean, not a new phrase, but it was certainly something that most people weren't familiar with until we were forced to face it. And there were some really dark moments in February and March when we as a country were trying to get our hands around, okay, so we have this new virus. What does that mean? Can we do anything about it? And things outside of our control seem really scary. So the simple fact that as a population, we coalesced around the importance of managing this virus and getting it under control from a health perspective, from an economic perspective, is to me is just so encouraging. And it's one of those one of those things that I think we'll look back on in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, and the historians will write a really powerful and positive story about how we all did what was necessary despite the pain to try to help save, you know, our fellow man, our fellow woman, and to keep people safe. I think that's so, so important. And if you look at the curvature of the infection trajectory, we have done that globally. And here in the United States, we've done that. So I think that is so positive. And I think we're all kind of used to that at this point that, oh, yeah, I guess things have slowed down. We've probably hit peak infection. That's become such a common story at this point that we might even take it for granted. But when you look at the numbers and the way that we slowed down that exponential growth, that is an overwhelmingly encouraging and positive data point from this that I think we can all pat ourselves on the back for. And I think another one is just the resources that the scientific community is putting into tackling and battling this disease. It's remarkable to see how almost overnight the light switch went on in the scientific community globally, not just here in the United States, but globally, to say, you know what, we have a real challenge. This is a serious challenge, and it's something that we need to throw all of our resources at and figure out very quickly. Otherwise, we're going to be in a real dark place down the road. And to see the dollars and the brain power and the resources that have gone into the therapeutic side is awesome. And what we're seeing there, you know, from Gilead Sciences and, you know, from some of the studies on inflammatory drugs and RA drugs is all really interesting. But on the vaccine side, to give your listeners a little bit of context, the quickest vaccine ever created took about 4 to 5 years. And here we are, 6 months since breaking down the genome of this virus, and we are already entering phase 2 trials, which is going to include about 600 participants with Moderna, who's probably the leading candidate right now in the vaccine race with the NIH. And, you know, they're going to be in phase 3 trials in late July. And this is remarkable. Dr. Fauci was talking about just recently about maybe having a vaccine available by December. It's the pace that this has undergone in the race to a vaccine is just, it's awe-inspiring. And it really is a testament to ingenuity and to innovation and to the smartest people in the world working on big problems. And I think that's fantastic. And then I think third of all is just the compassion we show for each other. You know, as I'm looking through kind of the good news in the world and trying to balance that with all of the with all the scary news, people are so willing to help each other out. And whether that's, you know, donating to the food bank or whether that's dropping off groceries to your neighbor who's immune compromised or maybe is older and doesn't want to go out and risk getting the disease, people are reaching out a hand to their neighbors and to their community and to the economy at large. And to see that kind of, you know, mass cooperation and empathy is just, it really reignites your faith in humanity and your faith in that we can get through this. We can tackle really hard problems and get through this with the right amount of compassion and with the right amount of shared resources and love. And I just think that's so, it's not only touching, but it's really encouraging to see those three things all working together to get us through what is a really interesting time to be alive and a scary time to be alive. So I think that's how I would summarize perhaps maybe the good news that your listeners can pay attention to.
Jason, thank you for ending on an optimistic note. We've been speaking with Jason Ware. He's with Albion Financial and Mountain Money. We'll be right back.